It is March the 9th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm David Byrd in Washington. Coming up, the United States calls for the UN to help with North Korea.
They've given us enough reason to think how irresponsible that they are that we ever try and think that we're dealing with a rational person on this.
Also ahead, the world marks International Women's Day. We'll look at what happened here in the United States. The UN Special Envoy for Syria says talks will resume later this month. The battle over a Republican health care plan continues on Capitol Hill. And how was the Silk Road formed? Well, stay tuned to find out. It's all on today's International Edition. Thanks for being with us. I'm David Byrd, and let's start out at the United Nations, where the U.S. Ambassador, Nikki Haley, says the United States must see some sort of positive action from North Korea before any discussions to lower tensions on the Korean Peninsula can begin. After an emergency closed-door briefing among members of the U.N. Security Council, Haley said that North Korean leader Kim Jong-un is not a rational person, and the Council is not ruling anything out in its re-evaluation of North Korea.
If you look at the situation in 2016, think about it. Two nuclear tests, 24 ballistic missiles by North Korea. That's not normal on anybody's radar. That's concerning on everybody's radar. And it's something that the world needs to be focused on.
The Council's closed-door briefing was held on North Korea's latest ballistic missile launches, which prompted calls earlier from China for North Korea, South Korea, and the United States to take steps to avoid a head-on collision. Ambassador Haley said that Pyongyang has made its intentions clear, and the world cannot take it lightly.
They said that their goal is to be able to reach U.S. bases in Japan. This is not something we can take lightly. The global community needs to understand every country is in danger from the actions of North Korea. And every country needs to respond in the actions of North Korea.
Before Wednesday's meeting, Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi proposed North Korea suspend its nuclear and missile activities, and in exchange, the United States and South Korea halt joint military drills. At the State Department here in Washington, spokesman Mark Toner said that the U.S.-South Korean drills cannot be compared to North Korea's recent moves.
What we're doing in terms of our defense cooperation with South Korea is in no way comparable to the blatant disregard that North Korea has shown with respect to international law and international concerns repeatedly about its nuclear weapons program. And And frankly, you know, the world needs to understand this isn't about the U.S. and North Korea. I mean, the world, certainly the region, but the world is threatened by nuclear North Korea's actions, and every nation needs to look at how we can better respond.
North Korea fired four ballistic missiles into the Sea of Japan's northwest coast on Monday, which coincided with the start of joint U.S. and South Korean annual defense exercises in South Korean territory. The plans to deploy the Terminal High Altitude Area Defense System, or THAAD, have angered not only North Korea, but also China, which sees the system's powerful radars as a security threat. Taking a look at some of the top stories around the world, armed insurgents disguised as doctors attacked Afghanistan's largest military hospital in Kabul Wednesday, killing at least 30 people and wounding dozens more. Afghan security forces killed all the assailants. Fire swept through a crowded children's shelter near Guatemala City early Wednesday. At least 19 people died and dozens were injured. A couple of hundred U.S. Marines have deployed into Syria with heavy artillery guns as part of the ongoing preparation for the fight to oust the Islamic State group from its self-declared headquarters of Raqqa. Iraqi soldiers recaptured a prison outside Mosul that had been controlled by Islamic State jihadists. And Lou Duva, the Boxing Hall of Famer who handled the careers of 19 champions, including Evander Holyfield, died Wednesday at the age of 94. You can find expanded coverage of these stories and more on the voanews.com website. Turning now to the world's International Women's Day. Thousands of women from across the United States took the day off Wednesday to show their economic value in a move that coincided with International Women's Day. Here in Washington, protesters marched to the White House while they shouted slogans condemning a decades-old policy recently reinstated by President Trump that bans U.S. foreign aid money from being used to provide or promote abortions. That policy is known colloquially, as the Global Gag Rule. Outside the U.S. Capitol building, Democrat House members led by Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi held a rally attended by more than 100 demonstrators. Pelosi said if she ruled the world, she would see to it that all girls around the world are educated.
And I return to where I began with this. If I ruled the world, the one thing we would do to make the future better would be the education of girls, not just here in America, but across the world. Because when women succeed, the world succeeds.
In New York City, protesters gathered outside the Trump International Hotel to protest the new administration's policies about abortion rights and the future of Planned Parenthood. Reshma Saljani was one of those activists.
I'm a mom, like many of us here are, right? And we got a lot to do, not just run organizations, but take care of our young ones. But every single day, I use my voice, and I need each and every one of you to do the same. It's going to be a long road, ladies, a long road. But we can do this, and we can show our power, so we must resist. Resist.
Rachel Martino was also attending that New York march.
With defunding of Planned Parenthood and, the question of what's going to happen with health care, birth control, all these kinds of things, it's honestly, like I said, it's scary.
In San Francisco, hundreds of women rallied on the steps of City Hall, speakers calling for greater economic equality for women and urging more women to run for public office. In Denver, hundreds of women marched around the state capitol. Patricia Rodriguez took a vacation day from work.
6 years ago, I pledged allegiance to this flag here, and I became a U.S. citizen. I'm Hispanic, and, you have to stand for the flag. You have to stand for what it represents, and it's human rights, women's rights, diversity, and inclusion, so that's what I'm here.
In Michigan, a tattoo parlor inked customers on Wednesday with special female empowerment designs as part of the celebration. Abby Rose was one of them. All proceeds from the $50 to $100 U.S. tattoos at Lovely Monkey Tattoo are going to the Ann Arbor chapter of Planned Parenthood. In Florida, a small but determined crowd gathered in front of an immigration office in Miami. Lutzi Sugi is the gender justice organizer for Miami Workers Center.
We know that we live in a Miami-Dade County where more than 40% of its residents are foreign-born, and we appreciate that, and we want to uplift that, and we want to let our community members know that we see you no matter what our local politicians say.
International events Wednesday included an all-female kickboxing tournament in Toronto, Canada, a 10K fun run in Brisbane, Australia that saw 10,000 women run through the city streets, and a literature festival in Dubai, United Arab Emirates, that was centered on gender equality. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm David Byrd in Washington. The UN Special Envoy for Syria says that a fifth round of talks aimed at ending the country's civil war has been scheduled for later this month. Speaking in New York on Wednesday, Stéphane de Mistura said the various delegations would be invited back to Geneva on March 23rd to continue their negotiations.
My current intention is to bring the invitees back to Geneva for a fifth round with a target date of the 23rd of March, with invitees arriving around the 22nd of March and ready to work on the 23rd March.
The special envoy said that the current round of negotiations did not work miracles, but no one expected it to. However, he was pleased with the progress made by the two sides.
We did not expect miracles, and frankly, we didn't have miracles. But we achieved much more than many people had imagined we could have. No one left everybody stayed. They went focused. We got an agenda. We got a timeline. We got some agreement even on substance.
De Mistura appealed to the UN Security Council to support unhindered humanitarian access, including to the besieged and hard-to-reach areas. He also called on all parties to the conflict to abandon what he called the fantasy that there can be a military solution to the six-year-old war. Here in Washington, House Speaker Paul Ryan on Wednesday defended the House Republican health care plan as the only alternative to the Affordable Care Act known as Obamacare. He did that even as opposition grew from both conservatives and medical professionals. Speaking after a closed-door meeting with other Republicans, Ryan said that the new plan would get the federal government out of the business of being what he called a nanny state. Shortly after Ryan's comments, two committees, the Powerful Ways and Means and the Energy and Commerce Committee, kicked off what are expected to be marathon sessions to finalize the legislation that would scrap major parts of former President Barack Obama's health care overhaul while also fundamentally restructuring Medicaid for low-income people. Republicans on the Ways and Means Committee blocked a move by Democrats to delay a vote on the health care plan to allow more time to read it. Texas Republican Michael Burgess said the Congress has to put patience above politics.
Mr. Chairman, unfortunately, the Affordable Care Act is packed with Washington mandates and federal regulations. One of the biggest cost drivers is the one-size-fits-all, Washington-knows-best approach, and I believe we are going to go far down the road of correcting that with this legislation today.
Democratic Representative Mike Doyle of Pennsylvania sharply criticized the Republican plan, saying that it only offers health care to those who can afford it and don't need it.
This is a bad joke. No wonder you've been hiding this dog in a cave with an armed guard until Monday night. No wonder you're not holding hearings on this bill. No wonder you're rushing through this markup. No wonder you're going to try to vote it in 2 weeks. Today, Republicans give you survival of the fittest, starring health care for the healthy and wealthy. For the rest of Americans, you're going to pay more money. You're going to get less coverage.
President Donald Trump and Vice President Mike Pence back the new plan and said that Paul Ryan is confidently predicting it will pass the House. Major conservative groups, however, oppose the bill, as do several GOP governors. The American Medical Association said Wednesday that the bill would result in millions of Americans losing coverage and benefits while making coverage more expensive, if not out of reach, for poor and sick Americans. But the U.S. Chamber of Commerce sent congressional leaders a letter in praise of the plan, calling it absolutely critical in taking steps to restore choice, flexibility, and innovation to the nation's health care markets. The Republican plan, that is, would repeal unpopular fines that Obamacare imposes on people who don't carry health insurance. It would replace income-based subsidies, which the law provides to help millions of people pay premiums, with age-based tax credits that may be skimpier for people with low incomes. Those payments would phase out for higher-earning Americans. Coming up, researchers find a link between type 2 diabetes and cancer in Asians. We'll travel down the Silk Road with Steve Barragona, and if you have a few million to spare, an auction next month might be just what you're looking for. You're listening to VOA.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA Podcasts a try.
VOANews.com.
Visit our website at VOANews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA Podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong.
You love music?
how about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. I'm David Byrd in Washington. Turning now to health, a link has been found between type 2 diabetes and cancer throughout Asia. As VOA's Jessica Berman reports, the incidence of diabetes is rising around the world, and as it does, experts say more cancer screening may be called for among Asians with diabetes.
Researchers at New York University's School of Medicine found that diabetes increased the risk of cancer death among Asians by an average of 26%, a statistic similar in the West. Data for the new study drew on an analysis of 770,000 people with type 2 diabetes throughout East and South Asia. The countries included India, Bangladesh, China, Taiwan, Singapore, South Korea, and Japan. The average age of participants at the start of the study was 54. Participants with the disease were followed for an average of 13 years to see if they developed cancer and what types. During that time, more than 37,300 cancer deaths were identified. Study lead author Yu Chen is an epidemiologist professor at NYU's School of Medicine's Department of Population Health. Chen says Asians with type 2 diabetes are more likely to be diagnosed with rarer cancers than Westerners, including cancers of the liver, thyroid, and kidney, which was double the risk compared to non-diabetics in Asia. People who had diabetes were also more than 2.5 times more likely to die from cancer of the endometrium and 1.7 times more likely to die from breast cancer compared to Asians who were not diabetic. The number of cancers of the gallbladder and bile ducts in Asia were comparable to those in the West, according to Chen. Those sites are closer in the body to the pancreas where insulin is made. Chen thinks there may be several mechanisms at work. Chief among them is scientific data suggesting that insulin may in some way stimulate the growth of cancer, according to Chen.
Patients with diabetes, they have high level of insulin, and some cancer cells, they're very sensitive to insulin. So it may, promote the tumor growing.
The findings were published in the journal Diabetologia. Chen says the study was undertaken because research focusing on an association between diabetes and cancer throughout Asia has been small. She says the findings suggest type 2 diabetes should be added to the list of cancer risk factors, along with diet and cigarette smoking.
Cancer prevention needs to take into account for diabetes. Lifestyles related to diabetes may reduce risk of diabetes and also cancer.
Chen says perhaps diabetics should receive more cancer screenings in addition to medical interventions to reduce the risk of diabetes overall. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
The Silk Road connected East and West at least as far back as the 3rd century BCE. Goods and ideas traveled across two continents among the great civilizations of Asia and Europe. But a new study says a critical middle link over the mountains of Central Asia was paved by the hooves of nomads' livestock. As VOA's Steve Barragona tells us, rather than seeing herders as marginal players, the new study puts them squarely at the center of the ancient exchange.
Look up the Silk Road, and you'll likely find something like a highway map, a network of lines connecting cities from Xi'an in the east to Genoa in the west. But in the middle are the mountains of Central Asia.
Yeah, I mean, the mountains have always been perceived as a massive barrier. And that's not for nothing. I mean, they're really big and tall mountains.
Washington University anthropologist Michael Fraschetti says via Skype that these mountains are not much smaller than the Himalayas. When researchers think about how the Silk Road got through that barrier, Fraschetti says they often look for the path of least resistance between cities.
And that makes sense if your destination is the other side. But what if that's not your destination?
Frischetti has worked with herder communities in the mountains of Kazakhstan. He says for millennia, they have migrated up and down these mountains with the changing seasons.
Their number one priority isn't taking the easiest path. Their number one priority is feeding their animals along the way.
As they travel from pasture to pasture, they meet and trade with other herder communities. These meetings are like festivals, he adds. They're times when goods are exchanged and bonds are formed. Frischetti's previous research modeled how Bronze Age herders may have moved through the mountains of Central Asia from highland pastures in summertime to lowlands in winter, but it had nothing to do with the Silk Road.
You know, and people kind of smiled and said, that's an interesting way of thinking about herding. And that's kind of where it's at. I mean, literally for almost, 11 or more years.
But recently, study co-author Tim Williams at University College London mapped 258 known Silk Road sites. When Frischetti and colleagues lay their map of likely livestock routes over Williams' map of Silk Road sites, they lined up remarkably well.
I think it's a very big deal, and I'll say on two particular fronts.
Dan Rogers is curator of archaeology at the Smithsonian National Museum of Natural History. He says finding how Silk Road traders got through the mountains is important, but the research also changes a perception of the nomads of Central Asia. From ancient Chinese literature to modern movies about Genghis Khan, he says,
nomads are portrayed as bloodthirsty barbarians, essentially. And what we're finding is a much more complicated picture.
Frischetti says it's a picture that pushes back against isolationism.
Through interaction with basically culturally diverse populations, a greater aggregate civilization arose. That's a pretty powerful notion.
Steve Barragona, VOA News, Washington.
The music of Yo-Yo Ma and the Silk Road Ensemble after Steve's report there. Post-war German artists stole the show at a Sotheby's contemporary art auction in London on Wednesday, where the total sales were up 70% from the same time last year. The highest bid of the night went to German painter Gerhard Richter's Iceberg, which sold for $21.6 million, including a buyer's premium. That's a new record for a Richter landscape painting. George Baselitz's Mit roter Fahne, or With Red Flag, fetched $9.1 million, setting a new record for the famed post-war German artist. Sotheby's contemporary art specialist George O'Dell described the two painters as pillars of post-war German art.
Gerhard Richter started as a photorealist painter in the 60s and then moved into abstraction. So this painting is quite interesting because it's based on a photograph which he took in 1972, but was painted in 1982. And the 80s is really when the full exploration of abstract painting starts. So this is a great later example of his photorealist painting style. With George Baselitz, on the other hand, the heroes are considered his greatest works, really focusing on the German identity immediately in the post-war years.
Another record was set for German artist Wolfgang Tillmans, whose Freischwimmer 119 sold for $566,000. This was the third time a record has been broken for Tillmans, who currently has a major exhibition in London's Tate Modern over the past year. Last week, a painting of flowers by Gustav Klimt sold in London for $59 million, a record for a work by the Austrian artist, and the third highest price for any work sold at auction in Europe. Sotheby's said the sales indicated a thriving art market. Over the past week, sales have reached over £500 million in the major London art auction houses. Maybe art isn't your passion. Perhaps you're in the market for something that sparkles a little bit more. If you are, a collection of rare emeralds, including one of the largest museum-quality emeralds in the world, is set to be auctioned in New York, April 25th. The Marcel de Gomar collection includes emeralds salvaged from the wreck of the famous Nuestra Señora de Atocha, a Spanish galleon which went down with its treasure off the coast of Florida in 1622. If you've ever been to Key West, Florida, you've seen the Museum of the Atocha, where they found all the gold. Arlen Ettinger is the president of Guernsey's auction house. He says one of the stones on offer, called La Gloria, is expected to go for between $4 and $6 million.
And we have a stone referred to as La Gloria, 887 carats, one of the largest museum-quality emeralds in the world. We are putting an estimate on that one. I'm trying to recall now, probably in the $4 to $6 million range, but it will sell for what people bid for it.
Other pieces up for bid include loose stones, several emeralds set in gold and silver jewelry, as well as gold and silver coins that were also rescued from the Atocha. The spectacular emeralds in this collection were collected by Manuel Marcial de Gomar, that is, during his career in both the United States and Colombia, where for years he worked in the legendary Muzo mines, widely known for producing the world's finest emeralds. You've been listening to VOA's International Edition. You can find us at voanews.com and follow us on Twitter at @VOA_IE. Thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jimmy Cook. And thank you for joining me. I'm David Byrd in Washington.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
North Korea is an authoritarian state led by the Kim family for more than 60 years. According to the newly released annual State Department Human Rights Report, human rights conditions in North Korea remain abysmal. The government subjects citizens to rigid controls over many aspects of their lives, including denial of the freedoms of speech, press, assembly, association, religion, movement, and worker rights. The government operates a network of political prison camps in which conditions are often harsh, life-threatening, and include forced and compulsory labor. According to the 2015 Korea Institute for National Unification white paper, the Ministry of State Security administered prison camps or Kwanli-so camps. There are reportedly between 5,000 and 50,000 prisoners in each of the five Kwanli-so. Reports indicated that conditions in the prison camp and detention system were harsh and life-threatening, and that systematic and severe human rights abuse occurred. Detainees and prisoners consistently reported violence and torture, and defectors described witnessing public executions in political prison camps. Numerous defector accounts and non-governmental organization reports describe the use of torture by authorities in several detention facilities. Methods of torture and other abuse reportedly included severe beatings, electric shock, prolonged periods of exposure to the elements, humiliations such as public nakedness, confinement for up to several weeks in small punishment cells in which prisoners were unable to stand upright or lie down, among others. Mothers were in some cases reportedly forced to watch the infanticide of their newborn children. Defectors continue to report many prisoners died from torture, disease, starvation, exposure to the elements, or a combination of these causes. The 2016 White Paper on Human Rights in North Korea, published by the Korea Institute for National Unification, and the 2014 UN Commission of Inquiry report stated that officials had in some cases prohibited live births in prison and ordered forced abortions as recently as 2013. Promoting human rights and democratic governance is a core element of U.S. foreign policy, said U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson. These human rights reports, he said, demonstrate the United States' unwavering commitment to advancing liberty, human dignity, and global prosperity, including in North Korea.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. We'll be right back.
is for